And welcome, guys, to another edition of the Morningstar Men podcast. This is our Just After Thanksgiving Day podcast, and this morning we discussed the topic of blessing. So as you're going to hear, as you listen along throughout the morning, or throughout the podcast, blessing is connected in some ways with legacy. In some ways it's an extension of legacy. But as you're going to hear, repeated several times throughout the discussion for the morning, we want to look at legacy, as which we discussed several weeks ago, as the foundation that we build for and pass along to other people. In other words, it is the starting point from which the next generation can begin to build their lives. The better the legacy, the better the foundation. But legacy alone, a good legacy alone, is not enough. And what we look at for the morning is that blessing is also essential, and blessing is the process of building into the next generation the belief that they are worthy to carry on and can carry on. And it is instilling in them the confident hope that they can build on the foundation that's been established for them, and that they can fulfill God's plan for their life in their time and in their place. And so that's what we're going to explore throughout the morning. I believe this is going to be a very practical lesson. You'll hear me say this, but I want to emphasize it right now before you even begin. Grab something to write with, take a few notes, because unlike many other of the lessons that we have, this one has immediate actionable steps. In other words, the process of beginning to bless the next generation can begin this week. The process is something that can't be left to accident, should never be left to accident, and so I encourage every man listening to begin to think of how you will craft a unique blessing that is fit for each of your children. Perhaps if you're a foster parent for some of your foster children, or perhaps if you're a coach or a mentor in some way, that you will begin to think of how you can craft that unique blessing for each of the people that you have great influence over. I hope this is going to be a great encouragement to you, and I truly hope you're blessed. Please consider sharing this with another man, a father who might be struggling with what he needs to say to his own children. I believe this can be a help to every single man. All right, guys, hope you have a great week. See you again next week. Have a moment, turn over to, we'll just say, the 6th chapter of Hebrews, and just park it there for a while until we get until we get to that point. So a couple of weeks ago, we looked at the concept of legacy. And today we're going to look at blessing. There's going to be a lot of overlap, and it's going to feel like, in certain respects, we're covering the same territory. What I'd like you to think of is that blessing is probably like a subset of legacy. It's a little different. Needs to be understood in a slightly different way. And here's the important part. Some of this material is kind of abstract. Some of what we've talked about so far, you just sort of listen and you think, yeah, that's a good idea. And someday I'll probably start to put that into practice, or maybe I'll begin today to put it into practice. But it might be years before I see the effect of it. I want you to take very specific notes this morning, because this is something that is very actionable. As I look at the few of us that are here, you give evidence of some years of, we'll say, life experience. I think that would be a polite way of putting it. And as those who have some life experience about us, we're entering the phase where this idea of blessing is really important. So you can either do it kind of by accident, or you can overlook doing it altogether, or you can be extremely intentional about it. So even in the process of preparing this, and I think I have thus far in my own fathering done a significant amount of this work, but even this week I'm thinking I need to do some more work in this regard. So I hope you're going to hear some very concrete things that you will want to do. So be looking for them. All right, so here's what we say. Is that legacy is about the foundation that we build underneath the next generation. It's about what we leave for them. Blessing is a little different. Blessing is instilling in the individual that's going to be blessed a confidence on their part that they can actually use what you've given to them and that they can actually follow through on their part of the deal, their generation's responsibilities. So it doesn't do any good, for instance, if I leave Ron with $1 million, but Ron has no confidence that he'll be able to skillfully use the $1 million. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so if we set the next generation up for success, but in their own minds, they don't believe that they can be successful, that they're up to the task, think about how daunting that would be. So before we get into this anymore, is there anyone whose life has blessed you in that way? They have given you the confidence necessary to pick up, to move on, to be what they feel you were called to be. Is there anybody you can think of? And I saw your head nod. Yes?
Father and father-in-law.
Okay. Anybody would have to say, that they can't really think of that much. Yeah. I think I was fortunate in that, at least from my father, I got a lot of that. But if we're in a room with this few people, and we got even a couple of heads shaking, that's not a good situation. I mean, what would it be like? Multiply this ratio by all the people in our country, by all the people in our world, and say that percentage of men have never really been spoken into and assured with some sort of confidence that they have what it takes to move forward and carry the hopes and the dreams of humanity into the next generation. This really is a big deal. And it's a big deal that men tend to shy away from in a lot of respects because it can get a little bit emotional. So when you sit down with someone face to face, across the table, or in some ceremony, and you start to speak words into them, how many of you struggle to communicate richly and deeply with people? Some do, some don't. I mean, you know the classic stoic guy story. It's like, I told my wife I loved her when we got married, and if anything changed, I'd have let her know, right? And it's been 20 years, and nothing's happened in the meantime. All right, so obviously that might be a little bit of an extreme, but sometimes we just don't like to have those conversations. Now, on the flip side, when you're raising kids, if your kids are out of the house, or if you're raising kids, how many of you found it difficult to yell at them for something they did wrong? What's that?
In the beginning it was. But
in the beginning, but you've grown into that task somewhat. Okay. So I think we generally find it relatively easy to correct people. Sometimes we find it much more difficult to speak words of affirmation, more than that, to paint a picture of their future. So there's some words here on the page that I've put in bold. Commissioning, or challenge, confidence, hope, expectation, heritage, and then finally legacy. These are some words that sort of commingle with the idea of blessing. So remember, in a blessing, we're focusing on the other person. Let's turn over to the text in Hebrews now. There's a couple of important principles that we're going to take out of this text. I'm going to hope that you discover some of them, but blessing requires that you become something before you can give something. We'll start in verse 13 of the 6th chapter of Hebrews. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore to himself, saying, "Surely I will bless you and multiply you." And thus, Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So there's a lot contained there. The first thing that Paul is saying is that the ultimate commitment to something is found when a person swears by something. Like you go into a courtroom and a person swears, puts his hand on the Bible, and so help me God. So what's the person doing at that moment? There's both action and there's statement. What's happening there? I mean, assuming they don't intend to perjure themselves. They're making a commitment. They're making a promise based on what they know. And there's two more things found there. They're agreeing to be held accountable by who? The highest source that they know. Whether they believe in it or not, what they are saying is, I am vowing to you to tell the truth, but I am holding myself willingly accountable to a higher authority, i.e. God, so I will have to answer to God if I do not tell the truth to you, but also, who is going to ultimately give me the power, the ability to fully disclose what I'm about to be asked to disclose? It's God. So help me God. So I allow myself to be held accountable. I find power in that accountability. And in that process, then I'm able to speak. And just write those notes down, those ideas, because they're very powerful to the concept of blessing. All right, for by people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of promise the unchangeable character of His purpose, He guaranteed it with an oath. So if God were going into the courtroom, what would it sound like? So help me, right? Exactly. That's exactly what it would sound like, because Paul is saying there's nothing higher that anyone could swear by. All right, so then when God makes this promise, why do we hold confident to this promise? Because God has nothing higher that He can swear by. God has held Himself accountable, and God has committed according to His accountability to Himself not to violate His word, and therefore the promise that He makes to us, He will follow through on. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. There's another great phrase, a sure and steadfast anchor for the soul. If you have a real Bible, the kind with real pages, you could underline that. Okay. Show off. Oh, of course it is. A hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So the first principles, and this is the introduction to the concept of blessing, the first principles are this, that when I bless someone, I'm not doing it only on my own authority and my own power. So if I, let's just pretend that Ron is 30 years my junior, and I choose to bless Ron because Ron and I are close, and maybe we're family or something like that, or I found Ron orphaned on the street one day and took him in and raised him up. And as you can see, I haven't done a very good job, but that's neither here nor there. So, Ron knows me, right? I've raised Ron. Ron really knows me. That means Ron knows both the good in me, and he knows the flaws and the imperfections in me. He knows the frailties in me. So when I bless Ron, and I say that I believe that Ron has a promising future, and that Ron is able and capable to fulfill the things that God calls on him to do in life, Ron thinks to himself, what does this schmuck know about my future? He can't even manage his own present, let alone my future. And so, how valuable is that blessing? I mean, it might be better than nothing, right? I mean, if Ron has a little respect for me, and that's important, The person that is conveying the blessing needs to be respected by the person who is going to receive the blessing. Otherwise, the blessing has no value. But given that we're all humans, the person that we're blessing, because we know each other intimately, another important component, blessing is bestowed on people that we know and is received by people that know us. There's an intimacy involved in blessing. It isn't just this blanket statement that I bless people that I've never met. I mean, I guess the Pope does that once in a while, where he stands out on the balcony and he blesses the masses, but he doesn't really know them. And it really doesn't speak volumes into their future. The unchangeable, sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. Why is that important now? We've got to put all this together. Because every one of us is going to have dark days. Every one of us is going to have months, perhaps years, perhaps whole seasons of life when it doesn't feel as if the purposes of God, the purposes that even we felt were God's purposes in our life, are being realized. And what do we start to think about ourselves? I mean, after all, we have one of two choices. We can either say God failed and God's a screw-up and God can't make good on it. All right, and some people do that. Well, if we're going through the dark season and we're having doubts, and if we assume that God isn't the problem, then who's the other logical problem source? Right. So it's either God's a screw-up or I'm a screw-up. Well, which is more believable? Right. You all said that with enthusiasm. And what do you turn to at a time like this? This is why blessing is so powerful. Because exactly like legacy, and this is where they're connected, our legacy goes to where we never will, our blessing goes to times and places that we will not reach. That's why it's important, and we won't be there sometimes at those times to reassure the person that we've blessed, you're still able, you're still capable, this is still within your reach. God still does have a promise for you. All right, so into chapter 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem. How would your kids describe you? And I'm going to assume that first and foremost this applies to children, either biological or adopted. It's one of the most powerful ways, the relationships in which we give blessing. Not the only one, but probably the first and foremost. How would your kids describe you? Because your blessing will only mean as much as the assessment that your children have of you. If your children think little of you, then bestowing your blessing on them means what? Very little. Yes.
In that context, I mean, when you sacrifice and give your children things and they see the true amounts of things that you have, I think they understand the blessing more so than when you're just doing things that you want to do. And even sometimes you do it for you instead of them, and then you give them something. I think there's a different sense of appreciation there. But if you're consistent on giving to your kids, they may not get it when they're pre-teens or even in their teens, but they'll get it when they're in their 20s, 30s, and then they can understand it, the impact that it had, and then they can understand it, the value of the blessing.
And since you phrased it that way, let's return to the concept of legacy. Because what we said in the week on legacy is, if you give people financial foundation, but don't give them character foundation, what's the chances of them using well the financial foundation that you've given them? It's diminished at any rate. It might not be negligible, but it is certainly diminished. So when we, as you're saying, sacrifice, What we want to do is we make sure that we're sacrificing for the right things, not just necessarily to give them more stuff, even to give them a better financial. We are sacrificing to do things that will build character into them. We're certainly sacrificing to give them opportunities for learning and whatever. But sacrificing solely to give them more stuff is not necessarily important. So for instance, if you're sacrificing to give them more stuff, but in the end, it's costing you the opportunity to be with them, then you've left them with the wrong legacy. And this all comes back to this simple concept of how you value yourself. And I said, you cannot bless someone in a way that is inconsistent with how you see yourself to be. If you see yourself as being a man who is called by God to a particular role, then it gives you some authority. So here's the way this kind of works. So we have the person who is doing the blessing, or the blesser. Guess that would make this guy the blessee. I don't know. Is that better? Okay. But remember what we said. There has to be some accountability. So we have accountability. And this is why a rich blessing is going to include God. If you're a person of faith, it is going to include God. What's the connection? Now study all of the connection here. Let's think about that for a minute. No? Okay. Remember the courtroom setting. I am about to speak. The words I am about to speak, I swear, are going to be the truth. See, Greg is my friend. Greg knows. Scott can look me right in the face, see that I have emptied my coffee cup, and ignore it. Yes, you have. I receive your blessing. Before God and man, I do. Yes. I am about to speak words into your life. I am going to have to face God, and I'm holding myself accountable to God. That means the words that I speak to you cannot be exaggeration. They cannot be fiction. They can be a believed future that is not yet realized, but they are a believed future that is not yet realized based on what? Based on my ability to make that come true in that person's life? No, based on God's ability to make that come true. Does that make sense? I speak words of blessing into another person's life in the presence of God and based on the authority of God. Who does God authorize me to speak words of blessing to? Those that He's authorized me to. So I need to think this through. Am I the person that God should or would choose to bless this person? Or am I just speaking pious platitudes that mean nothing? But what's the other component of this relationship? The person who has been blessed in the presence of God. That means God overheard the words of blessing. This person is going to look to God for the power and even the authority to follow through on what was delivered in that blessing. But this person is also accountable. Because now this person doesn't want to squander the blessing. Because if they squander the blessing and misuse it, who are they accountable to? To this person? No. To this person. Now, do you see why it matters how you think of yourself? Because if you don't think of yourself as a man under authority from God, then what authority do you have to bless somebody else? It's just your fond wishes and hopes for somebody else. Well, since we've all been lied to in life, right? Is there anybody here who hasn't been lied to in life in a significant way? Since we've all been lied to in life, we all have a sneaking suspicion that we could lie to other people. This person over here, he knows by now. That's why this element of God's presence in this blessing is so important. It's why a lot of guys are uncomfortable. If you don't have a strong, solid spiritual foundation, if you're not walking with God, how can you invoke God's presence in this blessing? It's not enough to say, well, once I went down to the altar at the front of the church and I said this prayer and I kind of half-heartedly remember it and all that. If I am not walking with God on a daily basis, then I do not possess the authority to give that blessing. But here's the next thing. How many of us really want the generation that went before us to speak words of confidence into our lives and say, you are the chosen for this time. You are the right person for this place. And with God's help, you will be able to do this. How many of us want that, honestly? I mean, we might pretend we don't want it, but at the deepest, darkest moments of life, when we how many of us have ever had self-doubt? Right? Every one of us should be able to say yes to that. What do we turn to when we have self-doubt? I mean, a lot of us turn to what? Self-confidence. But since we're doubting ourselves, what confidence will we have in ourselves? So before we can bless someone, it's incumbent on us that we develop that faith walk with God, that relational experience with God that allows us and empowers us to speak these words of affirmation. And incidentally, if we don't introduce this generation to this God, then that accountability means nothing to them. And your blessing means even less to them. Questions before we move on? I hope I'm giving us all something to think about, because this is not just, well, I'm building more wealth in my 401k and someday I'm going to die and maybe there'll be some left and my kids will get it all. It's not that kind of. This is intentional planning for your future and how you are going to set yourself up for a handoff. I know I'm going way out of order from the notes, but that's another important component of it. Blessing is often perceived as handoff. What do I mean by that? It's another reason why guys are not really good at this. Who wants to say, yes, tomorrow I go to be taken up to my father's and I will be buried in the ground and I will be no more? Who's the guy who wants to say that? I mean, if you're having a bad day, maybe it doesn't sound like such a bad idea. But when life is going well, we don't want to think of our mortality. And in a certain sense, when we bless the next generation, what are we saying? They're the ones that are taking over the reins. And what does that make us? That makes us the has-beens. Once we were great, but now we are no longer great. Huh? Lame ducks. Okay. And if I'm not secure in who I am, not secure in myself, but be secure because of what God has done and what God promises, if I'm not secure, then do I ever want to let go of that mantle of authority? Even figuratively speaking? I mean, that doesn't mean that you're not going to be the lord of your own house, of course, right? When you're in the retirement home and drooling, you'll still be the lord of your rocking chair. But that aside. All right. So let's turn over and look at a couple of blessings. Let's go over to Genesis 27. I noticed, Scott, that when you get a little hungry, you go over there and help yourself. Why, Scott, is that a Boston cream donut? Is that what that is? Oh, of course there was only one. All right, if we're all at Genesis 27, getting back to being really serious and focused here. Don't just listen to this as theory. I want you to be thinking right now about things that you want to start doing that will put you in a position to bless somebody. And incidentally, because in our generation, in our time, in our culture, it's not customary that, for instance, I'm going to bless Bill, and Bill is going to carry on the whole family lineage. I mean, people leave home long before, typically. You want your kids to leave home before your demise. You really want them to do that. You don't want them to be lingering in your basement when you're 80, waiting for your blessing so that they can move on in life. If they're still in your basement and they're 35 years old, then it's time to give them the blessing or the boot, one of the two. 27. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, and this is what I'm saying, this is where this transfer of authority and power comes in. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." And he said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death." So what's he saying?
Any day now.
Yeah, that's it. Could be any day. Let me speak a precautionary tale here. I'm going to take this a little bit out of the order of the notes, but it's in your notes. Here's a recommendation that I have. Write a blessing down for your kids. I mean, give some thought to it. If it takes you a month to put it together, 15 minutes here, 20 minutes there, come back to it, look at it. And I mean, fine-tune it. Because if something were to happen to you next week, what would your kids have? A finely crafted, written blessing that really, truly expresses your God-ordained and God-empowered beliefs for your children might matter in the event that you're no longer there. And there are stories of children who have received this from parents who were in car wrecks or prematurely died in one way or another, and it's meant an incredible amount to them. It really is a good step to take. And not only that, it's still a noble and worthy gift to give to them, even if you are there to hand it to them in person. I don't know about you, but I tend to forget words. I mean, it's not that I want to, but somehow if someone looks you in the face and speaks words of confidence into you, that's good for a little while, but don't they tend to fade after a while? Have you ever gotten a good letter? Once or twice in your life? Have you ever returned to the letter again? You ever read it a few more times? And that's the power of this blessing written down. So I would really encourage every one of you to do that. All right, back to the text. "Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat and that my soul may bless you before I die." Everything that we're going to read here is pretty much going to be re-emphasizing what we've already discussed. What do we see about the relationship here between the one who is going to give the blessing and the one who is going to be blessed? Anybody? Can't hear you. Okay. But he's asking him to go hunt. In other words, Dad knows that Esau is a skilled hunter. Dad takes pride in Esau's hunting. Not only that, what's he say? "So that I may eat and my soul may be satisfied." What's his assumption? Do we know people that have come back from the hunt with nothing? What's he saying? "I know you, my son, and if I send you out on a hunt, you will come back with something." See, that's confidence right there. Dad is speaking this belief into his son. "I know that if I send you out on this mission, you'll return." What else is contained there, right there, in that little bit of text? "This is something about you that I appreciate. I enjoy this. I have been privileged to have you as a son, and you have hunted before, and you have cared for our family in that way. I like this about you. This has been something that we have shared in the past." The blessing must in some way commingle things that are shared experiences. It must speak personally to each person you're going to bless. It's not enough to just have some random abstract words that you use. "Now Rebecca was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went out to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebecca said to her son Jacob, 'I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat and bless you And here's the phrase, before the Lord, before I die. So right there in that phrase, and it doesn't appear in the paragraph above it. But it's clear that Rebecca heard it. And so right there we have all three. That's where we get this idea, these three beings present in the blessing. All right, so we all know the story of the trickery and the chicanery and the stolen blessing. But let's move over then to verse 26. And now this is Isaac who is going to bless Jacob, whom he thinks is Esau. Is everybody familiar enough with the story that you're following along here? So let's look at the words. See the smell of my son, it's the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. All right, now that might not sound like it's very meaningful to you and me. It probably isn't. I don't want to be known as smelling like a field. But what did Jacob hear? It was supposed to be Esau. What did he hear there? Praise from his father. Admiration. This is the thing that his dad valued most. And the things that his dad valued most, he is saying, and I see those qualities in you. It would almost be like, I don't know, being a Cowboys fan and having a win and saying, I see that win and I appreciate that win and that's marvelous. Not that that would apply to anybody here, but just in case that were to have meaning. May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let's read that again. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. So who does he appeal to in the blessing? He appeals to God. Why? I mean, is it just a nice statement? There's a conclusion that we have to draw here.
God's going to carry the whole family.
Yeah. Not only that, but Isaac has confidence in God's ability to do this. Why? You can't speak the blessing that is authorized by God into another person's life if you have never experienced God's provision and care in your own life. So if you've never been through some tough scrapes, if you've never seen God come through in your own life, what can you say about God other than, boy, I hope He shows up in your life because He sure didn't in mine. And then he moves into some specifics. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers. And may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be everyone who blesses you. And as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac his father. I mean, they really double down on this. It's almost like out the back door while the next one's coming in the front door. Esau, his brother, came in from hunting, and he also prepared delicious fruit and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me. His father Isaac said to him, who are you? Now think of how that hurts. I mean, I know there was a lot of trickery went into this. But what does it say? My dad really didn't even know me. I am your son, your firstborn Esau. And then Isaac trembled very violently and said, who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it before you came, and I have blessed him. Now listen to this. I have blessed him. Now what would you want to happen? Okay, so they both figure it out. Excuse me. Jacob has been a trickster. What do you expect that Isaac would do? Yeah, right? Exactly. Hey, you scrawny little second-born runt, get your butt back in here. You can't have what I just gave you. And your stew wasn't that good anyway. But what does he say? And he shall be blessed. What's the implication? There's honor behind my words. I cannot take back my words. My words are irrevocable. And therefore, the words that I have spoken over this individual, even if it's the wrong individual, those words have to stand. Think about how solemn an expression that is. That means that these words that are spoken, you need to give thought to. As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." Again, more rich meaning. What do we see in that sentence? And. Remember, this is an adult male. The firstborn male. A guy who's capable and confident and can go out and kill something and bring it back and feed his family. And yet, what is the cry of his inner man yet? Recognition, approval, and blessing from his father. And the only difference between him and most men today is most men today wouldn't say that they crave that blessing even if they do. The lesson for us as fathers is this. When our kids pretend that they don't need this and don't want this and that they're beyond that and they don't value it, is that true? It's not true. And so nothing should dissuade us from delivering this because we know, we have inside information as it is, that there is a place in their hearts, a place in their minds that requires filling and that we are the people that can fill that and only we. But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing." And Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright. Behold, now he has taken away my blessing." And then he said, "Have you not reserved for a blessing for me?" These words of Isaac are kind of interesting. "Behold, I've made him Lord over you and over all your brothers. I've given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. But what then can I do for you, my son?" And Esau said to his father, and it's like he's pressing him. He won't let up. This is really amazing, and it implies that there is something really desperate inside of Esau. Can you imagine your kids? Now just think of your kids the way you know them right now. And you created this ceremony and you were going to bless them. And then you gave the words of blessing to somebody else and they begged you once to bless them. And you said, "I don't have anything left." What do you think they'd do? Would they stick around and beg a second time? No, they wouldn't. I can think of, they'd have some rather graphic illustrations for me. They'd show me precisely what they thought of me. They'd turn their back on me and walk out of the room. Well, at least my sons would. Maybe I just didn't raise them very well. I don't know. But anyway. But look at this ache and this vulnerability. And I will still maintain that this is somehow true of every child, that they long for this blessing. And then Isaac, his father, answered him and said, and this is the blessing that he gives to Esau, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother, but when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now, it doesn't sound like a marvelous blessing, but it actually embraces who Esau is. It doesn't sound like a marvelous blessing because it was spoken at the last minute. In other words, and here it is, in this culture, there was one dominant blessing given, and everybody else had to settle for the leftovers. That's what was expected. Let's turn over to, I think we're going to Genesis 48. We'll start at the first verse in 48. After this, Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is ill." All right, so if you know the story, they're all now down in Egypt. Joseph has been the savior of the whole family. He's provided them food. He's asked them to move down to Egypt out of where they were living. So they've settled. They've been there a while. I'm sorry. Jacob is now at the end of his years. So after this, Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is ill." So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, "Your son Joseph has come to you." Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a company of people, and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession.'" Now, he's leading into a blessing. How does he start? How does he introduce this ceremony? More than before, we see this triune relationship. God is involved in this blessing, and he says, "This is what God promised to me at the beginning of my adult journey. When I left home, when I set out away from my father's house, God met with me, and this is what God promised to me." Isn't it interesting how he remembers that all these years later? He remembers that encounter with God all these years later. And it's important to him, and he wants to make sure that Joseph hears this. "And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are." So Reuben and Simeon are the first of Jacob's biological kids. And so what he's saying is, "Joseph, you've made a different life for yourself. You're already a ruler in your own right, and you have a different situation. And so what I'd like to do, if you're willing, is adopt your children and bless them with the blessing that was apportioned to you. And the children that you fathered after them shall be yours." Anybody know what the principle of the dividing of an inheritance would have been in a typical Jewish family? All right, so Jacob has how many kids? Huh? 12. 12 total. Jacob was a busy guy. Jacob had two wives. When his wives couldn't come up with more kids, his wives threw their maidservants at him. Joseph was a busy guy. Joseph went to be with his father as a happy guy. Well, maybe not. Too many women can spoil the broth. So anyway, we have 12 kids. So you would divide the inheritance. In our thinking, you might divide the inheritance 12 ways. All right? Here's what happens. When Jacob says, "I'm going to take your two sons, Joseph, and I'm going to adopt them," he's taking one out of the equation. Now there's 11. But we're going to insert this 12th child. And so I'm going to give your two children each a share of the inheritance. It's double the representation of any other person. So the oldest son, the preferred son, the chosen son, always got twice what anyone else does. That's going to matter later on. So when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons whom God has given me here." And he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see, so Joseph brought them near to him. Do you see how this story is being replayed? You remember the Jacob and Esau and the blessing? How was Jacob able to trick Isaac? Isaac couldn't see. So Isaac could be fooled by touch. The same thing is occurring here, it seems. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand, toward Israel. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand, towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand, toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him. So he's trying to position them in front of Jacob so that the oldest of his two sons is going to get the dominant blessing. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the hand of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on the hand of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, and this blessing is the one that is going to apply to Joseph's sons. And the God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And in them let my name be carried on, and the name of my fathers, Abram and Isaac. And let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. How many generations do you see represented there? Count them. This is the audience participation portion of our show today. Yeah, depending on how you read it, there's multiple generations. So we have Abram, we have Isaac, we have Jacob is three generations, we have Joseph is four generations, and Jacob is placing his hands on the fifth generation. Five generations are represented right there and speaking into the future toward generations that are not yet known. This is an additional important component of blessing, and it's why on the first page we introduced the idea of commissioning. A blessing is more than just your fond wishes and hopes in the presence of God dispensed toward those who will go after you. A blessing is also the changing of authority or power in some sense, in that this next generation is going to carry forward the family legacy. Look at what it said again. The God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked. So these guys have been long dead and their influence is still felt. Each of these has been blessed in turn and each of these sensed a commitment to the generation before it. Do you understand what I'm saying? You're not only appealing to the future, you are looking, if you have a favorable past, into the past and saying, this is the legacy that is being handed to you. This is the family that is being placed in your care to keep. These are the responsibilities and duties that it is now your generation's responsibility to keep. And I am trusting you and confident in you that you're going to be able to carry forward with them. So this is more than just, may you grow fat and happy in the land. It's, may you remember that you have a responsibility. And one day you're going to stand in front of the next generation. And obviously this works. It works because Jacob is able to appeal back to two previous generations and say, I am upholding the legacy that was passed on to me. Now, suppose, this might be a good place to stop, suppose you don't have that. A first generation has to start somewhere. See, it doesn't go any further back than Abram. Why? Because there's nothing before that that can be looked to as God's involvement with those people. Do you understand what I'm saying? So Abram was the first generation. So suppose there is no previous generation that has bestowed a blessing on you, you can be the first to start this new process. So don't be dissuaded by the fact that you don't have a heritage to reach back to and point to. Begin in your own generation to push forward. Let my name be carried on in the name of my fathers, Abram and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And so the blessing carries with it a vision for a future. Now, incidentally, a multitude in the midst of the earth is more than one generation's work, right? I mean, if you were to start out even with a family of 12, do you think that in the next generation you could fill the earth with a multitude? You'd have to be as busy as Jacob and even busier, wouldn't you? So what's he doing? He's speaking out multiple generations. He's saying, and you will have a legacy to leave to the next generation and to the next generation. So he's speaking words of hope and promise out through the generations. And by implication, what he's saying is, but this chain can be broken if you're not willing to pick up your part. And this is all part of that blessing. And then if you turn over to chapter 49, and I don't want to belabor this, but this is important. Then Jacob called his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell to you what shall happen to you in the days to come. And what I would like you guys to do on your own is read chapter 49. Here's what we learn. Remember Isaac? He doesn't have but one blessing to give. That Jacob got that blessing. But do you remember the part in the story where we read how Jacob was barely out of his father's tent before Esau comes in? Remember I pointed that out? Do you think that Jacob didn't hear Esau's wailing? Think about that. Jacob knew the pain that Esau experienced. And maybe as a young snot, forgive me, but maybe at that point he didn't really care. But later on in life, he started to reflect about that and he started to realize the pain and the despair that he inflicted with his mother's help, incidentally, with his mother's coercion, actually, that he inflicted on Esau. And what was the promise that he sometime in his life made to himself? Isaac struggled to have words for two kids. Jacob here has thought through words for 12. You understand what I'm saying? Jacob vowed to himself, when I get to the point in my life where it is my turn to pass on this blessing, I'm not going to stop with the first child. I'm not going to find myself without words for the second and the third and the fourth. I am going to have words of affirmation or encouragement or hope or correction to speak. As a matter of fact, we will read a couple of verses from chapter 49. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. This is their blessing, incidentally. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. Oh, my glory, be not joined to their company, for in their anger they killed men, in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, a couple generations later, the word Levi is associated with what? The priesthood. Did you see, this wasn't a perpetual curse on them. What it was a warning. And that's another component of blessing. A blessing is also a warning. Remember I said that to give a proper blessing you need to know each child? That means you know both their strengths and their capabilities and the opportunities that are before them, but you also understand their weaknesses fully. And in the midst of that blessing, you're going to speak words of caution to them about their areas of weakness. Okay, let's turn over to... Does nobody have anything to say? No comments, no questions, no anything. The audience is not very participative this morning. Tell you what, we're going to forego the... No, we won't. Let's go over to Numbers. We can do this quickly. Numbers 27. You have confidence in my ability to make a point quickly, right? All right, we're going to go down to the 18th verse. We're in Numbers 27. So the Lord said to Moses, Take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hands on him. Make him stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight. So Moses' time, as a matter of fact, if you go up to verse 12 there, it says, the Lord said to Moses, go up into this mountain of Abraham and see the land that I have given to the people of Israel. When you have seen it, you shall be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was. In other words, after you've seen that, you're going to die. So before you die, I want you to hand choose your successor and to take him, and before the priest, you're to commission him and bless him. I think we've covered this, but we need to say it one more time. This is kind of a big deal, and this is why I say it can sort of be uncomfortable. This is the kind, but a blessing is something that you might want to have a special dinner with family, or with that individual, or some sort of ceremony. And men are maybe not as good at this as women are, but I think some sort of celebratory event is necessary. Notice in the blessing between what turned out to be Jacob and Isaac, there was food involved. There was a special meal. It was a meal that was actually Isaac's favorite food. So there was some ceremony. Here, Joshua is being commissioned, and it's done before the priest and before the congregation. There's a ceremony of sorts. Why? Because a ceremony gives a certain amount of recognition to it. It makes them a solemn thing. It's not the same as some casual comment like you're riding in the car together for 3 hours and working up the nerve to say something, and then the person jumps out of the car, and as they're running the other way, you say, oh, and I think the world of you, and I hope you have a great future. That's not much of a blessing. All right, so turn over now to Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter. The reason we're taking so much time with this is I'm trying to give us all some ideas. I think I said 31, didn't I? It's what I have written down here. I don't have it written on your page. All right, we're going to Deuteronomy 31, 7. Now this is the final it. So Joshua had previously been commissioned, but there would be a little bit of a gap between the commissioning and the actual execution of the assignment. Then Moses summoned Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you shall go with his people into the land that the Lord has sworn to your fathers to give them. And he shall put them in possession of it. It is the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Now remember who's giving the blessing. So if one of the guys in the camp said that to Joshua, just one of the average guys in the camp, would that have had significance? Probably not. These are the words of Moses. Joshua respects Moses. He holds every word of Moses in esteem. And Moses says, and you can do this. This conveys this idea of respect. So you have to be building into your own life the qualities that are going to make your words worthy of being heard and worthy of being valued. All right, now we'll go over to 1 Kings 19. Got a phone. You don't need to know anything except push the little magnifying glass and then type in the... I mean, what do you need to know? It figures out where it is.
It's just a matter of getting there first.
So you're bragging about the fact that you have faster thumbs than he is?
Exactly.
So you're not really looking for a powerful blessing from Scott because you really don't respect his words all that much, huh? All right, so we're going to 19 of 1 Kings, chapter 19. We're going to go to the 9th verse. If you're familiar with the basic context of this story, this is Elijah in the cave. He's already done the whole thing with the fire coming down from heaven and the prophets of Baal and all that thing, and God has proved himself mighty, but Jezebel threatens to kill him, and so he runs like a scared chicken and heads off for the hills. And that's a whole other story, but here he is in this time, and he's really kind of in despair. He's done some miraculous things. He has stood firm and fast for years, but right now he's kind of like the way any of us can be, where we're exhausted, we're confused, we feel threatened, and we just don't quite know how to process anymore, and so God takes him off for a little bit of time away. And there he came to a cave and lodged in it. Behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord of hosts." So in this case, he's saying jealous as in, I have craved after you, nobody else. I wanted your affection. I wasn't willing to share with anybody else. You and I have had a prized relationship together. "For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant and thrown down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I, only am left, and they seek to take my life." Well, that's not entirely true, because there were a number of other people who were faithful to God. But right now, at this moment, he's feeling pretty bad for himself. And so God said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke it in pieces." And you know that story, so we're going to come down to the part that matters. It says, at the end of that, he says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" God asks him again, and he says, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts." So God asks him the same question again, after all this display, the power, the might, and then the still small voice, and God asks him the same question again. "So why are you here now?" Hoping that he's going to change his answer. And it seems like the same answer again. "For the people of God have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I, am left, and they seek to take my life." I mean, it's word for word almost the same as it was the first time. "And the Lord said to him, go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria." So God still has work for him to do. Who is this guy? This guy stuck in a hole in a cave in the mountains. But God says, "I want you to appoint the next king of Syria." So God still sees in Elijah things that he doesn't see in himself. "And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of whatever that is, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. Now you got to see how enthusiastically he commissions Elisha. This is just great. "So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with the 12 yoke of oxen in front of him. And he was with the 12, and Elijah passed by him." In other words, just walks by him. "And cast his cloak upon him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah." That's Elisha does. "And says, let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I shall follow you. And he," and this means Elijah, "said to him, go back again, for what have I done to you? And he returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh." So at this moment, Elisha is more enthused about this call that he's gotten than Elijah is. It's like, it's not a big deal. Look, I'm just on a walk. I tossed my cloak on you. It's like, don't read too much into it, kid. Let's turn over to 2 Kings 2. Incidentally, in that last chapter, that last story that we read, it's amazing, but Elijah himself doesn't realize the power his words have over Elisha. Elijah even downplays his own words. They probably don't mean that much. It's not a big deal. How does Elisha respond? I mean, if you look at the story, what he does is he ends up killing his own oxen, taking the wood that was the yoke. I mean, when you kill your oxen, it's like when you're a farmer in Nebraska and you got one tractor. And you pour gasoline all over it and light it on fire. It's like not a good day, the day you kill your oxen. You're not going to be long in the farming business if you kill your only beast of burden. And invite your neighbors over for a barbecue. I mean, that's not a good day. So what's the commitment level of Elisha? It's all in. You bet it's all in. I certainly can't go back to that anymore. And yet Elijah's kind of downplaying it. We're over to the second chapter here. Of 2 Kings. Did I tell you that? Then when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven. Okay, so this is it. Elijah knows that his days are numbered at this point. Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. So there he is. He's followed right along. He's been tagging along the whole time. And Elijah said to Elisha, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." So again, he's trying to dissuade him, or perhaps test his commitment. But Elijah said, "As the Lord lives, as you yourself live, I will not leave you." All right, now there was every reason for Elisha to say, "Okay, I'll hang out here." It might have been a 40 or 50 mile walk. Now, it's not like that was uncommon for them, but it wasn't like it was just a day's journey and it would be no big deal. You'll be back for dinner tonight. It wasn't that kind of a journey. It was, if we go there, we're going to be days walking to get there, and then we're going to be days walking back. Why don't you just hang out here? Elisha is so committed to this mission that he says, "No, I'm with you the whole way, the whole time." So they went down to Bethel. And the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you?" And he said, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet." Now, why does he want that not to be talked about? Okay, well, let's look at how Mr. Pleasing Personality Elijah himself has handled the relationship so far. His commissioning is, he walks by the guy, throws his cloak on him, and says, "Eh, it's no big deal." His day-to-day mentoring process is, "Listen, kid, why don't you stay home?" Right, so what do you think the exchange is going to be? If there's one area where Elijah seems to be weak, it's that he's not Mr. Warm and Fuzzy, and he doesn't have a very engaging mentoring process about him. And so the last thing that Elisha wants is to have this confrontation where he's afraid Elijah might just blow up and say, "That's it, I've had it with you, just go home." Elisha desperately wants this. And so Elijah said to him, "Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." All right, so great. It's not just a to and back. Now it's a to and, oh, there's been a detour, and we're going to walk another 20 or 30 or 40 miles. But he said, "Please stay here." And then he says, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. And the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you?" And he answered, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet." The same thing. So wherever he goes, Elisha is hearing the same words spoken to him by people who represent God. "Your time has come." Incidentally, this phrase today, when you look at the distance, and it says today, and then he wants to walk more, and then it's today again, it ain't the same day. It's just a capturing of the immediacy. In other words, we might want to say, very, very soon this is going to happen. It's not a literal today. You with me on that? Okay. Then Elijah said to him, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." It's almost as if the guy's trying to get rid of his charge. "Would you just scram, kid? Beat it." "As the Lord lives," he said, "and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. 50 men of the sons of the prophets also went and stood at some distance from them. And as they both were standing by the Jordan, then Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water, and the water was parted to the one side and to the other, till the two of them could go over on dry ground. And this is the breaking point. This is it. This is the final point. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elijah, "Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you." Okay, fine. You've been persistent. You've demonstrated your persistence. What is it that you want from me? And Elisha said, "Please let there be a double portion of your spirit on me." And he said, "You have asked a hard thing." All right, now when you read that, what do you think that means? First blush, you read that and it says, a double portion of your spirit. What's that? That is what we tend to think of. Do you remember what we talked about, the inheritance? The firstborn who will inherit the responsibility gets twice the inheritance. What Elisha is actually asking for is, I would like the privilege of assuming your position. I would like to inherit, take over God's work where you leave it off. I would like to be that guy if you're willing. And he says, and he replies and says, it's going to be a hard thing. Why is it going to be a hard thing? Because who should be the one to decide that? Who should be the one to decide who takes over God's work? Yeah, it really should be God. So he says, well, you've asked a pretty tough thing. Yet if you see me as I am being taken away from you, it shall be so to you. But if you do not see me, it shall not be so. And as they still went on and talked, behold, chariots of fire and horses separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, "My father, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen," and he saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them to pieces. And he took up the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him, and he went back and stood at the bank of the Jordan. Now this is the telling moment, right here. Is this for real? Is God going to honor this promise made through Elijah? Right here it is. So I have the cloak, I'm wearing the cloak, but that doesn't mean I'm the real deal. Anybody can wear the cloak. The question is, do I have the authority that comes with the cloak? Then he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water, saying, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" And when he struck the water was parted to the one side and to the other, and Elijah went over. So it uses the exact same words that it just used to describe what happened on the way across the river to describe what's happening on the way back. And what's the confirmation there? Everything that Elijah was able to do, Elisha will be able to do. Mrs. Dumeyer, how are you today? You look rather dapper in your red scarf and... Oh. All right, we're going to do one final really quick story, which is supposed to be the culmination of this, and I'm sorry this is taking so long. Is anybody getting anything out of this? I mean, is any ideas, any thoughts, anything? Have you written anything down that you would like to impart to your kids in the way of a blessing or how you need to begin to... Because that was the whole purpose of this. Otherwise, this was just... Y'all wasted your time this morning. Well, except for Scott. He got a Boston cream donut. All right, so we're going over to Matthew, the 17th chapter. We're going to make this very quick, as quick as I can make anything. So after 6 days, Jesus took them with him, Peter and James and John his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to him Moses and Elijah talking with him. All right, have you ever wondered about the significance of this? Like, what is up with this weird story, and how does it fit into everything? Well, let's look at the two figures here. These three guys are invited up to witness something, and they're not really sure what they're witnessing. But yet they include it. They include this in the gospel story. Why? It's really confusing. But to them, after the fact, it's not confusing. There's a description of Moses that says that Moses was like no other man on the face of the earth, because it says Moses spoke with God face to face as a friend speaks to a friend. Remember reading that? What are they being told here? They're seeing Moses, the man who has spoken with God as a friend face to face. Where are they? They're in the presence of Jesus, speaking to God as one would face to face. This is part of their commissioning. Who's the other person that they're there with? They're there with Elijah. And Elijah is the one who will bestow the Spirit of God on Elisha. And in the same way, these guys, and it must have taken them years to sort this out, the mantle of God's authority is going to rest on us. And so the original definition of an apostle, as it was understood at that time, was one who had walked in Christ's presence and witnessed Christ's miracles and His teachings personally, and then one who was anointed for the mission. And so these two guys that are up there on this mountain represent those two components of God and what this apostleship will mean for these 12. Those who have seen God and spoken to Him as a friend face to face. Remember what Jesus describes them as in the upper room the last time they meet together for fellowship meal? He says, "I no longer call you servants, instead I call you friends." They have spoken with God as a man speaks with his friend. 40 days later, the Spirit of God would fall on these guys. They would be anointed specifically with power for a mission. And so the whole purpose to this transfiguration is to embrace these two components. These guys have seen God face to face, and they carry that with them for the rest of their lives. And wherever you read later on in the letters that they write to people, what do they appeal to? I know you find this to be far-fetched. I know you find all what we're saying to be almost inconceivable. But we've seen this stuff with our own eyes. We can't lie. If we said we hadn't seen it, we would be lying. And then God verifies their statements with His own authority through the acts, the miraculous acts that are done through the Spirit's power. All right. I hope I've given you some things to think about, maybe some things you can implement as you craft a blessing for your own kids.